Welcome, I'm David Alan Miller, and I have the great privilege of speaking with the legendary violinist Zhouliang Lin, or as he's known in Taiwan or in Asia, Lin Zhouliang, but we all know him here as Jimmy Lin. He's one of my dear, close friends, and someone with whom I've collaborated a great number of times, and is coming to the Albany Symphony on Saturday night, the 21st of September, to play the Shostakovich Violin Concerto No. 1 with us. But right now, I wanted to talk about other things with Jimmy. I wanted to find out a good bit about his past, maybe even a little bit about his childhood and his evolution as an artist. So, Jimmy, welcome to our program. We're so happy to have you with us.
Oh, thank you, David. It's nice to talk to you at any time.
So I really wanted to talk to you because you've had such a fascinating, multifaceted life, and you've played with virtually every major orchestra in the world, or most of them, and certainly everyone in the United States, and very active as a chamber musician, as a teacher, as an administrator as well, running your own incredible music festival out on the West Coast, and one, I believe, also in Taiwan. But let's start a little bit with something that's always interested me. Tell me about your earliest violinist experiences. I know you were born in Taiwan, and you spent a little bit of time in Australia, and then came to the U.S., but can you just tell us a little bit about that sequence of events?
Oh, sure. My father was a physicist, but he was very passionate about music, and he was particularly in love with violin music. I'm not sure why. My mother was a high school English teacher, and she loved music also. And so my house was always filled with music, and apparently when a next-door neighbor child, similar to my age, began to learn the violin, I would just drop everything that I was doing, including watching cartoons or playing with toys, and I'd run over to his house the minute I heard the violin being tuned, and then I'd just sit by this good friend's side and watch him practice every day, and until my parents thought I was a thorough nuisance to my neighbor. So they got a toy violin for me so that I would leave this poor child alone.
And was this all in Taipei, or where were you?
No, in Hsinchu, which is now the Silicon Valley of Taiwan. It was a quiet university town when I grew up in the 60s, but now it is the high-tech incubator of Southeast Asia. It's huge now, and I'm very proud of the development of that town, even though I don't recognize any of my old neighborhoods anymore.
And were your were your parents both born and raised in Taiwan and spent most of their lives there, or had they trained in the West? Or
No, they actually grew up in China. They all left China in 1949.
Of course.
When the Civil War broke out and the communists took over. And so they retreated to Taiwan along with the government because my grandparents on both sides worked for the government. So they just took off and took my parents when they were kids. And then they met in Taiwan after they graduated from college and got married. And I was born shortly thereafter in 1960.
And are you an only child?
Yes, I am.
Uh-huh. And so then what happened?
Well, then I thought that the violin was the neatest thing in the world, and I just wanted to do nothing but play the violin. So my parents, I think in those days it was even hard to acquire a proper violin. Taiwan was really poor in those days. So my father went on a scientific conference trip to Japan. And from Japan, he brought home a quarter-sized violin, gave it to me, and took me to my first violin lesson. That's how it all began.
Right. And then how did you end up in Australia? I seem to remember that before you came to the States, you went to Australia.
Well, that was out of necessity, even though it turned out great for me. I had to leave Taiwan because my teacher thought that I was getting a little too advanced for Taiwan or for what Taiwan could offer in those days. And U.S. was not quite available to me just because in Taiwan was still under martial law in those days, so getting a passport out of Taiwan was really difficult. I think a couple schools in the States offered me scholarship and admission into university prep programs, but the powers be in Taiwan refused to recognize that a 12-year-old or 11-year-old could actually be admitted into a university system, so they thought it was a forgery, so refused to let me out.
Wow.
And out of desperation, my mother sent a cassette tape to Australia to her brother. My uncle, this brother, took the tape to the Sydney Conservatory and played it for the violin teachers and the president of the school, and they immediately offered me a scholarship to their high school. And once the high school was on the letterhead, the Taiwan government allowed me to have a passport, and that's how I ended up in Sydney
And did your mom go with you, or how did that work?
No, it was very tough because my father had just passed away when I was 11.
How sad.
And then my mother recently widowed, had to let me go because she couldn't get an Australian visa. Australia had this white Australian visa policy. It's very it was a very racist regime in those days and really refused to give visas easily to any Asian nationals. So my mother had to join me about a year, or no, maybe 8 months later. But I lived with my uncle initially. So that was a big change, you know, switching from speaking Chinese to English.
Right, and you'd never, everything, you'd never really spoken English before, is that right? Or a little bit? Or?
Well, I studied English with my mom, you know, she being an English teacher. But it was, you know, different. One thing to speak English at home with one's mom, just in lessons, but the other thing is totally different when you have to immerse yourself studying every course in English, including English history. Can you believe that? I had to study about the Tudors and about the Elizabethan era and all this stuff.
Well, of course, all of
Australia
us...
history, all in English, and I had no clue what I was doing.
Well, all of us colonials have to do that, I thought. No, that's not true. Yeah, not exactly. Yeah, I guess my grasp of Tudor history could be much better. So you went when you were, you said, about 12, and then your mother followed eight months or a year later, and then did she end up living there with you? Or?
Yes. Uh-huh. And then I think I stayed in Sydney for 3 years, three wonderful years. Then I moved down to New York because I realized Juilliard was the school that I wanted to attend.
How did that come about? I mean, did you have to play for somebody? Or?
It went through several stages. You know, first of all, Itzhak Perlman showed up when I was 13 and played some of the most astonishing, most beautiful violin concerts I ever heard. Even to this day, I can't think of any violinist better. And I was very inspired. He came to my school in Sydney and gave a masterclass and played for him. And during the masterclass, he was talking to us, all the students, about his student days, studying with the famous Ivan Galamian and then the less famous Dorothy DeLay. And I was thoroughly intrigued by how Mr. Perlman shows such affection for this lady, you know, Dorothy DeLay. So I said to myself, I got to find out more about this lady. I mean, if she was able to produce a student like Itzhak Perlman, she must be a miracle worker. So I, but I was 13. I was not nearly ready to venture to New York. But it took me a couple more years, and I started to win competitions in Sydney and elsewhere in Australia. And I realized that maybe I was outgrowing Australia as well. And then a couple of visiting artists started to tell me more about Dorothy DeLay, and that was my destination. I wasn't sure if I could get into her class because Juilliard allows only live auditions. So I had to fly all the way to New York, hoping that I'll get into both the Juilliard and to the studio of Dorothy DeLay.
But Perlman wasn't, I mean, didn't he actively help or not really? Or
No.
Oh, he
Perlman
didn't help.
Just played his concert, heard me play for 30 minutes during the master class and left.
And that was it.
I didn't see him again until I was 16 in the Aspen Music Festival.
Oh, I see. So then you did get into Dorothy DeLay's class, and that was quite a class you were in, from what I gather.
That was very exciting. You know, I walked into her studio for the very first time for my first lesson, and there's a huge photo of Itzhak Perlman in performance. And I thought, oh, man, I'm going to be like the worst student in her class in all of Juilliard. I just have to work my way up. It was very intimidating. But anyway, I got to know some of the older kids, you know, Nigel Kennedy's, Shlomo Mintz, Mark Paskanoff, some wonderful older players. They gave me great inspiration. But, you know, I also fired up my competitive instincts. I thought the Juilliard was the best thing that could have happened to me.
New York will do that. It often will do that to anybody. So you got to her when you were about 16? Is that when you got to New York? Or
15. 15. I was 15 years old.
And did your mom come with you then or no?
No. Oh. I she didn't actually come to New York for another 14 years.
Wow. So you were completely on your own at 15.
Well, I was very lucky. I had a wonderful American family, Susan and Porter McKeever, who took me in. Really, that's their new child. And they looked after me and found schools for me and really took care of me. I was very fortunate. But I was very much, you know, I had to really work on my violin and other things, you know, very hard because I knew my mother had, you know, sacrificed a great deal for me. But then, you know, I was absolutely passionate. I remember going to Carnegie Hall. You know, listened to my very first concert. I remember Zubin Mehta and Pinchas Zukerman playing the Mendelssohn Concerto and with the LA Philharmonic, and Mahler 5 was the second half. I mean, I was in heaven. I thought I could not have found a better place to be inspired.
That's beautiful. This is David Alan Miller. I'm speaking with the great violinist Jimmy Lin, Cho Liang Lin, who's going to be appearing with the Albany Symphony on Saturday evening at the Palace Theater, September 21st at 7:30 p.m., playing the Shostakovich First Violin Concerto. Jimmy, when you got to New York and started working with Miss DeLay, she was such a legendary teacher and taught certainly almost all of the greatest American violinists of your generation and of subsequent generations. What was so magical about Miss DeLay? What made her so special?
Number one, she was very kind, very warm. I think she inspired her students and cajoled her students rather than intimidated her students or harassed her students. It was not the old school, sort of the teacher is the sort of the sacred icon style at all. She was very, I would say she asked more questions than she gave answers. She would ask me why I would play a phrase in a certain way or why should I make a sound this way. And it caused me to think. And I think by my third or fourth year, I realized I learned to teach myself. And that was a very important lesson because this method could be applied to my playing throughout my career. So it was very helpful. But she also had this uncanny ability to analyze anyone's playing and break a violin playing into components. Perhaps one doesn't realize that violin playing and the technical part involve so many components. Perhaps it's like a golf swing or like a tennis stroke, that you can have the right hand, the bow arm, with how you hold the bow, how much bow you use, what kind of technique you can apply to produce the sound. And then, of course, there's the left hand, produce the proper intonation, you know, in other words, to play in tune, and how to go up and down the fingerboard to play all the fast notes or slow notes in the right way. Those are very, very intricate things, and she was able to really break any student's playing down into these tiny components and then put them back together and make the player just that much better.
So she was a pretty technical teacher, because I've always wondered that, because, you know, I remember when I was at Juilliard, I did a master's there in conducting, and I remember there it was very famous when you walked by Ms. DeLay's studio up on the fifth floor, I guess it was, and there would be 20 or 30 violinists hanging out of all ages and stages waiting for their lessons, because she tended to, I guess, always run late. And they would all just be hanging out. And we always wondered, you know, what mysterious ritual was going on there that caused her to spew out such unbelievable artists. It was so incredible. So she was both sort of musical and technical. Is that true? Or
Yes. I would say more technical than musical, because she encouraged me to seek musical ideas from as far afield as I could, whether from fellow faculty members at the Juilliard or other sources, whether from concerts or from encounters with the likes of Isaac Stern or Itzhak Perlman or Pinchas Zukerman, Yo-Yo Ma, people like that. She was very welcoming to that. She wanted everyone to search out their own styles. That's why I think if you listen to her famous students, they don't play alike at all. Find a common thread that is among them, except maybe the fact that they all have good sound. That was a very important thing for Miss DeLay's teaching.
They do. You all do. You have such rich, voluptuous sounds, all the DeLay school. That's a real hallmark of that. Incredible. Yeah. So then as you were embarking, sort of leaving the Juilliard or beginning to have your professional career, it was such a, you know, incredible hothouse of the greatest violinists that America has almost ever produced. Not only Perlman and Zukerman, who obviously are a little older than we are, but, you know, the people you've mentioned before of Shlomo Mintz and yourself and Mark Peskunov and very many others, Nadja Slater-Sonnenberg coming up behind you and Nigel. And what was it like to sort of establish a career at that time for you? I mean, was it very difficult? Or?
Well, in all honesty, when I was about 16 or so, I thought it would be just the greatest thrill to be able to get into the New York Philharmonic one day and just join that orchestra. I thought that would be fantastic. And I didn't really have any sort of, other than maybe a dream here and there, realistic hopes of becoming sort of so-called soloist. But I realized I was climbing up. You know, Juilliard, at least among the violin students, there's this unspoken hierarchy. And it's pretty much recognized who is the hot one, who is, you know, going places. We all kept tabs on each other. And it was very exciting. I wasn't going around telling everyone I'm going to be a soloist, but I was, you know, secretly wishing that, oh, maybe I could play like so-and-so one day. And, you know, when Shlomo Mintz would go off and make his debut with the London Symphony, for instance, and we all became very excited for him because we thought, wow, here's one student among us who's, you know, doing this, and how exciting is that? Maybe he's the next Itzhak Perlman, or the, you know. So those were very exciting moments for me. And then when I realized that my career could take off, but I had to work very hard. I knew there was nothing guaranteed at all. You know, when I made my New York debut at 19, and then other big debuts in my early 20s, they were incredibly exciting moments. But I absolutely took nothing for granted because I realized how precarious any career can be.
And I gather you had some really legendary musicians watching out for you. I know you were very close to Isaac Stern. Is that true?
Mr. Stern heard me play and decided that he wants to perhaps lend me a helping hand. So he asked me to go over to his apartment once in a while and play for him. And then I was incredibly honored when he invited me to play chamber music with him in Carnegie Hall on his 60th birthday. And what ensued was really quite remarkable. I worshipped him because he was one of my heroes when I grew up listening to his recordings. And so I was able to play with him on his 60th birthday. I played for him in a tribute in San Francisco on his 70th birthday. And I ended my last concert with him on his 80th birthday in yet another chair music concert in Tokyo. And I think Mrs. Stern died sometime soon thereafter. Mm. So those are really poignant and important yardsticks for my own career, my own development. Not so much about career, it's about how much music I learned. You know, when I began to play with Mrs. Stern, I began to realize that I knew so little about music. I have, you know, zero clue. And then through the years, I began to learn and absorb. And by the time, you know, I played my last concert with him, Brahms G Major Sextet, I still remember that vividly in Tokyo, Suntory Hall. I realized that I knew a thing or two. And we had some wonderful reminiscence after that concert. Very late at night, we sat at a table. We started talking about all those years that went by. And it was wonderful. For once, maybe for the first time, I felt Mr. Stern was regarding me as an equal, not as a child. You know, that was wonderful.
And without wanting to name drop, I gather that there were incredibly illustrious other musicians who played chamber music with you and Mr. Stern, right? I mean, that was quite a group he would put together when he would put a group together. Is that right?
Well, I remember a Schubert string quintet with Carnegie Hall with Mr. Stern. Lena Rose was the cellist, and Pinker Zukerman was the violist.
Wow.
And I thought I was in heaven.
Right. You were okay playing second fiddle to Mr. Stern? That was good?
Well, it's like, you know, I felt like, you know, I might as well be playing third base in Yankee Stadium, you know?
Right. It's beautiful. So now that you're now a distinguished professor at Rice University, where I know you have a wonderful class of students and you're a much-loved professor there, and you're also, I know, at the Aspen Festival pretty much every summer, although we missed you there this summer because my son was out there and I went out to visit, and you sadly were not there. You were doing other things. How has your, you know, becoming an adult and a father yourself and a teacher, how has that sort of changed your perception of violin playing? And I mean, has it changed the way you look at the instrument and music making?
I think I'm more open-minded because I think it's important to let each student develop his or her own style, and imposing my own will upon them is not going to help. Even though I get incredibly, what's the word? I get really anxious for them because I want them to do well. And sometimes I get a little bit impatient. But nonetheless, I realize they have to develop at their own pace. And that's how Miss DeLay treated her students. I had to remember that. And same thing with letting my 12-year-old daughter grow up. You know, she had no interest in music. So I had to reconcile myself to that, you know, particular non-legacy.
Well, that's okay. Maybe she can become like her mommy and be a doctor. That would be good.
Exactly. Yeah. If she's good at math, which I wonder. But anyway, I do think
that can be learned even more than violin playing, maybe. I don't know.
Yes.
Math aptitude.
Indeed.
So, Jimmy, I've so enjoyed playing with you through the years. I feel like we've been pretty consistent collaborators. You've been to Albany 7 or 8 times, and we're delighted you're coming back on the 21st of September to play Shostakovich. I've had such wonderful experiences with you abroad. We played together when we were both quite young with the Australian Youth Orchestra. And then we, not that long ago, just 3 or 4 years ago, played together in Taiwan. And that was so exciting for me because I always think of you as a celebrity. But in Taiwan, you're a gigantic celebrity. And you kept getting recognized. And people would pull their car over to the side of the road and run after us to get your photo. And that was so much fun. I remember the night markets. Can you tell us a little bit about the night markets?
Night market is a huge part of Asian nightlife. And I was so impressed, David, that you knew not only how to go to the night market better than I did, but you knew what to order. You had already scouted the entire several blocks of these nightstands, food stalls. And I was so impressed, David. You knew more about Taiwanese food than I did.
Oh, it's not true, because I'd been there for a week before you got there, and I'd been trying all the different dishes, but there were certain things that not speaking Mandarin, I couldn't communicate with certain people. So I was so glad that, like, you introduced me to stinky tofu, which is a very famous dish at the night markets, and I was so relieved and delighted when you showed up and we could go hang out at the night market together. That was really a huge highlight of my career thus far. So
that was a fun week with me, for me, and to be with you. And
it was great.
My native Taiwan to you in my own way.
And you always play at the most incredible level. But when we did the Sibelius Concerto together, we played that one concert at the Sun Moon Lake, which is a famous resort right in the middle of Taiwan, a beautiful place, outdoor concert. And you played, even though it was a hot, sticky summer night, or whatever it was, a hot, sticky night, you played with such beauty and power. I mean, I think there's something about channeling your ancestors that just made it a very special thing.
It was a hot and muggy night, that's for sure. Lots of bugs flying around, being outdoors and everything, but it was a beautiful resort.
So, Jimmy, it's so good to talk to you, and thanks for sharing your past with us and your present, and we'll look forward very much to seeing you soon.
Well, thank you, David, and I always look forward greatly to every encounter I have with you.
Me
thank
too.
You so much.
Thanks a lot.
Violinist Zhou Lang Lin speaking with Albany Symphony Orchestra maestro David Allen Miller. Jimmy Lin will be performing with the ASO at the Palace Theater in Albany on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. To learn more, you can visit their website, albanysymphony.com. albanysymphony.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.